The first case in our calendar is 96203 Evelyn Davis, Administratix versus Immediate Medical Services, Inc., et al. Mr. Humphrey, I think you are going to go first, right? Okay.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may I please report? I represent the Appellant Alliance Immediate Care Incorporated and also one of the cross-appellees, Dr. Barbara Maneri. The various defendants have agreed to divide their time. I will take 9 minutes on behalf of the Appellant, and the other defendants will take 6 minutes. The first issue before this court is whether a default judgment may be awarded against a defendant employer who has not timely entered an amended complaint when the only cause of action against the employer is based on respondeat superior and the employer's employee is found to be not negligent at the time of file. In order to quickly bring this matter into focus, several procedural facts are important for this court's consideration. First of all, this is a medical malpractice case that was filed by the plaintiffs in 1992, naming five separate defendants. In 1993, an amended complaint was filed by the plaintiffs, and for the first time, Alliance Immediate Care was brought into the case on the amended complaint. The trial court set a cutoff for all motions before trial to be filed by April 4, 1994, notwithstanding this order of the court 3 days before trial. Specifically on the Friday before the Monday of trial, the plaintiffs filed a motion for default judgment because Alliance Immediate Care had not filed an answer. On the morning of trial, the court held a hearing.
Do you know when was it right after the hearing or the discussion with the judge, when the plaintiffs first learned themselves that the wrong party had filed an answer?
Your Honor, I do not believe that that was inquired into on the morning of the trial. I read the transcript.
So you don't know if they just discovered it a couple days before the trial themselves, or whether they knew it for months and just sat on it and kind of held it back and don't know the answer to it?
That's correct. I don't believe there's any indication either way. The trial court did hold a hearing, and attorney for Alliance Immediate Care, Attorney Gary Bannis, presented testimony to the court, actually, just to answer some of the court's questions, and he indicated on the record that his first notice that an amended complaint had been filed against Alliance Immediate Care, whom I will refer to as AIC, his first notice of that was on the Saturday before the trial when he was going to trial and came across the motion for default judgment that had been filed on Friday. The trial court asked the plaintiff if they would like a hearing on the issue of excuse or neglect, and you'll see in our supplement pages 60 to 64, the trial court offering that to the plaintiff. The plaintiff indicated that they did not believe that there was any need to put attorney Gary Bannis under oath, that they took his word for it that on Saturday he had first learned that an amended complaint had been filed against AIC. The trial court specifically found excusable neglect on the record and allowed attorney Bannis to file his motion for leave to file an answer and stand for on the morning of the trial.
What was the excusable neglect here? As I understand it from reading the briefs, the party, AIC, did get a copy of the complaint, no question about that, and there's an employee who just simply didn't send it to the lawyer. What's the excusable neglect? Was there any showing as to why that happened, or was it just an oversight, or what?
Your Honor, the only evidence before the trial court in form of the testimony provided from counsel by AIC on the morning of trial was that he had learned over the weekend that AIC had received a copy of the complaint, that it had not been forwarded to the proper person, and he had not received a copy of the amended complaint, and that his first notice of the amended complaint occurred on Saturday. And that would be the excusable neglect. Now, the plaintiff...
That sounds like it's excusable neglect for the lawyer to not have filed something, but it's the party here don't we look to see what the party did? I mean, the party is the one that got the notice, and the party, AIC, is the one that neglectfully did not give that notice or the copy of the complaint to its lawyer. Don't we look to so much of the discussion in the briefs was on the lawyer here. I mean, I think there's not much question in my mind. I guess that the lawyer was caught in a situation where its client simply hadn't done what the client should have done, and it's the client that's going to have to be liable for it, if anyone is, for that conduct. Don't we look to see whether the client for some reason didn't do what it should have done, or am I wrong?
Well, no, I think you're correct, Your Honor. I think for the purposes of that inquiry, the attorney and the client are one and the same. what I think that there are cases in the course of appeals in Ohio, especially Hopkins versus Chevrolet, a case that is cited in our brief where the complaint was not forwarded to the appropriate person within an organization, and that caused them to drop the ball and not forward the complaint to the attorney, and the court found that there was excusable neglect and that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing the vacation of the motion for default judgment. This matter did proceed to trial, and Dr. Guarneri, the agent of AIC, Dr. Guarneri was employed by AIC, was found to be not responsible. The argument before this court is that it would be both legally and logically inconsistent for a default judgment to be awarded against the defaulting employer when the employee has already been found to be not negligent. This doctrine was first recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Proud versus De La Vega, admittedly a pre-rules decision, but that court determined that it is wrong to have inconsistent judgments, one on behalf of a defendant employer and one on behalf of the employee who actually showed up and had the case tried. This court essentially adopted the Proud doctrine, although not stating so, in the case of Monocle versus Loader, a 1978 decision out of this court, where this court held that where there is no evidence that a master has been negligent, except through the theory of respondeat superior, then the judgment in favor of the servant renders invalid any judgment against the master.
But if the rules are violated, you never get that far, do you? I mean, assuming the rules were violated, we enforce the rules. What's bothering me is that, how do you get around Miller versus Lindt? Not long ago, we had a plaintiff in here who had violated the rules, and the carrier came in and said, if the rules mean anything, they sure mean you ought to follow them. Look at Miller versus Lindt. If you don't like the rules, court, then overrule it. Why do we change the rules for you?
Your Honor, number one, I don't think that you have to change the rules. In this case, the trial court, as an independent basis for its decision, could have determined that pursuant to Ohio Civil Rule 6B, because the court found excusable neglect in Attorney Mattis, attorney for AIC, did file a motion for leave to file the answer in standard, then the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing the answer to be filed on the morning of trial. So I don't think that the procedural rules in that sense
6B. You mean 60B?
No.
6B. The reback. Okay, I see what you're saying now.
And if this court would use the reasoning in Miller versus Lent to apply that to the facts of this case, this court would find that the trial court was correct in not granting default judgment. In Miller versus Lent, there was an auto accident. The defendant defaulted. The default judgment was awarded. The defendant then filed an answer, but without filing a motion for leave to do so with the court. In the Miller case, there was no motion filed with the court. In this case, there was a motion filed with the court on the morning of trial. In Miller, there was no showing of excusable neglect. In this case, there was a showing of excusable neglect. The trial court specifically found on the record that there was excusable neglect and offered the plaintiffs the opportunity to cross-examine Attorney Mattis to disprove that, and they specifically waived that on the record. In Miller versus Lent, there was a failure to serve an answer on the parties. In this case, an answer was filed and served to the parties through the motion for leave to file the answer in standard. So number one, Miller versus Lent is entirely distinguishable from this case because the trial court could have determined, and it did determine, that there was excusable neglect and allowed AIC to defend at trial. As a wholly separate inquiry, it would be totally inconsistent, even if there was a violation of the civil rules, for a default judgment to stand against an employer when the employee has been found to be not negligent. Essentially, what you're asking is are the procedural rules more important than the substantive rule of law in agency and principle law? And I would say that the substantive law is more important to be applied than the procedural law.
But counsel, do you really need to make that statement? Aren't you standing on the proposition that the procedural rules were met here? Inasmuch as 6B permitted the trial court to grant extension for filing the answer.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is a totally independent basis for this court to find that there was no abuse of discretion. And that's what I believe. However, if this court does not believe that that was met in this case and would apply Miller versus Lent, then I would submit to this court that it is more important to apply the Proud doctrine, Proud versus De La Vega, as adopted by the Supreme Court of Maryland in 1985 in a post-rules decision, to say that when a certain to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and allow the judgment rendered in favor of Dr. Guarneri and Alliance Immediate Care to stand. Is there no other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey.
Thank you.
Mr. Davis.
May it please the Court, my name is Willie Davis. I'm here on behalf of Defendant Appellant Ian Care of Alliance Incorporated. The issue which we are involved in this case is the Court of Appeals extension of the holding of the case of E versus Adrian South OBGYN, case decided by this court, which held that in a medical malpractice action where there is a commonality of interest between an expert witness and a defendant regarding their common insurance coverage, that that fact can be raised in front of the jury for purposes of impeachment to show bias. In this particular case, the Court of Appeals below found that the trial court should have permitted plaintiff's counsel to raise that issue of insurance coverage, even though the expert witness involved did not testify in any way, shape, or form regarding the actions of my client, E.M. Care of Alliance, which happened to have the same insurance company. So in other words, we have to, and the court's release on the factual basis in this case was, with all due respect, somewhat incorrect factually. In this case, as the court will recall, it's a case of a ruptured appendix. And this particular decedent, the patient, had several visits to medical facilities on different dates with different symptoms, giving different histories, and seeing different defendants. The first visit was at the urgent care center with Dr. Guarneri. Guarneri, I'm probably just pronouncing it. Dr. Guarneri was insured by an insurance company called PICO, Physicians Insurance Company of Ohio. Then the second visit, when the patient came back and saw a Dr. Seri at my client, E.M. Care of Alliance. E.M. Care of Alliance was insured by an insurance company by the name of the PI Mutual Insurance Company, or PIE. Also, OPIC, Ohio Hospital Insurance Company, is involved for another defendant. We have an alphabet soup here. It's a little hard to keep straight. But the bottom line being is that Dr. Guarneri, counsel, who was insured by PICO, retained an expert witness, an emergency room physician by the name of Dr. Bruce Janiak from Toledo. Dr. Janiak also happened to carry his own medical malpractice insurance coverage with the PIE company. Okay. Dr. Janiak, at the time of trial, on direct examination, testified solely as to the standard of care, and that standards of care were met by Dr. Guarneri. Trial counsel for E.M. Care of Alliance, the PIE insured defendant who was involved in the second visit, asked no questions. No other defense counsel asked any questions of this particular witness. The witness particularly limited his opinions to only Dr. Guarneri's care.
And your argument is that, and the plaintiff, as you know, says, well, Dr. Janiak's testimony, although he testified only as to Dr. Guarneri, that his testimony somehow helps the other defendants. Your argument to that, I guess, is that the other defendants were in different situations because of the treatment by multiple entities here.
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, that argument that the plaintiff cross-appellees are making in this case is absolutely incorrect. A reading of the record reveals that Dr. Janiak made a couple general statements. Frankly, if you read the record, plaintiff's counsel, as was noted in by the dissent by Judge Farmer in the Court of Appeals, worked mightily trying to open that door so that the issue of insurance could be told to the jury, even though the expert witness had nothing to say about the other co-defendants. And the expert witness, Dr. Janiak, only talked about the general role of a physician in an emergency room or an urgent care center in terms of that's the one who starts the ball rolling at page 56 of the transcript.
Counsel?
Yes.
since most of these cases are determined by expert testimony, shouldn't the jury be allowed to consider evidence of most any nature that touches upon the credibility of the witnesses who will determine the outcome of the case? Shouldn't the jury be allowed to know that he has the same insurance company that maybe other doctors in the emergency room had, or the other parties may have, and consider that as far as believing or disbelieving his testimony? What's wrong with that?
Well, the thing that's wrong with it, Your Honor, is there's nothing the matter with impeachment cross-examination to show bias. But the fact of the matter is that evidence, there has to be something to impeach. And in this case, there was nothing as to these co-defendants. Dr. Janiak basically talked about...
But he was testifying as to emergency room expertise in general, was he not?
No, he was not. He was only testifying on the standard of care, whether standards of care were met, as to the PICO insurer. I believe my time is up, Your Honor, unless the court has any other questions. We would ask the court to reverse the judgment as to the Amparo Alliance of the Court of Appeals on the basis that this case is very definitely factually dissimilar to the E case.
Just a short answer before you sit down. Is your argument the same as the E.M. Care of Alliance argument?
I am E.M. Care of Alliance.
Okay, so the immediate medical, you're right, we have an alphabet soup, and I keep looking at these briefs going back and forth. So yours is the same issue as the third. What I have listed in my notes is a third defendant. There are two of you the same.
Yes, Your Honor, except the other defendant on this issue is the Court of Appeals did not reverse the judgment.
That's why I'm asking.
Favor as to that.
That's why I was asking, because that makes a discrepancy, doesn't it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Plakas.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice. My name is Ian Plakas, and I represent the Appellate Cross Appellant, and I'd like to divide our time into 11 minutes for myself and 4 minutes for rebuttal, that pleases the court. Thank you. Your Honors, all litigants have a right to a level playing field. They all have the right to rely on a consistent enforcement of basic rules that govern the orderly, efficient, and fair adjudication of claims.
Counsel,
yes.
When did you figure out, were you trial counsel or law school? You were trial counsel?
Yes, I was.
When did you figure out that the Senate had not filed it?
The record doesn't reflect that. If you want me to go back and speculate from outside of the record, I can suggest to you that it was...
Let me make it simple. Was it like a couple days before you filed the motion for default, right, 3 days before trial, or was it like 6 or 8 months right when you early got into the case?
I don't think it was early in the case, but I don't think it was a couple days before. It was sometime within that period of time.
Is there some reason why you went and filed a motion for default as soon as you found out, so that all the parties could stop spending time, money, and effort to follow these rules you talk about?
Your Honor, in answer to that question, there are a number of issues in terms of strategy as to why we would want a corporate defendant to stay in a case or not be involved in the case. For example, this very case, you saw that before the case commenced, even though EM Care had its employee, Dr. Seri, we chose as a tactical matter to, by stipulation, dismiss Dr. Seri and proceed only with the employer rather than the employee in that case. Similar issues of strategy and jury psychology involve themselves.
So as a matter of strategy, you would like to keep the defendant in as long as you can and take advantage of whatever strategies you have, and then when it no longer becomes useful, then move for default. But they've already spent time, effort, money, depositions, expert witnesses, etc., and you're playing the game.
No, in fact, we didn't play the game because, in fact, in this case, Your Honor, defendant AIC never spent a dime of time, money, or industry, because apparently, if defendant AIC never sent the service of process to any counsel, at least according to Mr. Banks' statement, it wasn't in his file, that's all his statement says. So in terms of time, money, and industry, none of the parties were involved in terms of any unnecessary expenditure of time, money, and industry with regard to defendant AIC. In fact, if there was any prejudice and or any detrimental reliance, it was with regard to us because under the rules, and under our right, Your Honor, to rely on the rules, we had the right to 28 days after we served service of process to presume, pursuant to Rule 8 and Rule 12, that all of our allegations against defendant AIC were deemed admitted. At that point, we win against them. At that point, we don't need to spend any time or money against them, and we didn't. If, in fact, they, like the Phoenix, are allowed to now resurrect and come back into the case, we're prejudiced because, in fact, had we known that they could come back into the case, then we could have further explored discovery with them. We, in addition to a strict vicarious liability responding superior lawsuit, could have and often do and normally do amend the case to allege claims with regard to inappropriate selection or monitoring or supervision or credentialing of employees. That amended claim was never brought because there's no need to slay a dragon twice. That dragon was dead. The only thing that resurrects them now is their efforts, their hope in this court to say, after the fact, after a year of never responding and violating the civil rules, now because fortuitously their employee has somehow won, then they're off the hook. Also, Justice Strack, in answer to your question earlier as to the misnomer on the answer, at the time that the trial was commenced, it wasn't an issue of someone filing a wrong or incorrect or typographical error answer with regard to defendant AIC. In fact, at that moment, no answer had ever been filed on behalf of defendant AIC. And additionally, to this date, and even though, bear in mind, the record reflects that trial was a three-week-long trial, even after their violation of the rules was brought to their attention on several days before the first day of trial, 3 weeks of trial, at the conclusion of the trial, they still have not filed an appropriate answer. They filed a misnomer answer for immediate medical care.
Mr. Plotkin, we know that. I guess I want to move you to the, is this a vain act that if we were to adopt your position that you know this defendant was out of rule, in fact never has answered or appeared in light of the procedure of a 60B motion, then if this court were to affirm the reversal and the entering of the default judgment, even under the constraints of 60B, Can you envision a scenario that this would not meet the three criteria for 60B in light of the respondeat superior defense?
Yes.
That there's a meritorious defense now in as much as the employee has been exonerated from liability.
And I understand, of course, what Kamara is getting to, but there's, as we all know, three prongs to 60B.
Right.
It's got to be timely, there's got to be meritorious defense, and there's got to be that has been already discussed. In this case, the record was then and will forever, I believe, be virtually devoid of any indicia of excusable neglect.
Right.
So therefore, it's for us to speculate that there will not be.
I understand. Okay, excusable neglect is your what you're hanging your hat on. Okay.
Yes.
Counsel, before you those are you alluded to the loss of opportunity with respect to this defendant.
Yes.
Could you flesh that out a little bit? You didn't lay down on their dock, did you, in this trial because you thought you were ultimately going to have them on the hook anyway?
Oh, yeah.
You had a full-bore trial against the doc.
Against the individual. on the public conference.
Yes. So the only loss of opportunity with respect to presenting your potential claims against the corporate defendant was that you might have amended your complaint on negligent credentials. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
That's a complaint that you had an opportunity to file when you first filed.
Could have filed normally still because you don't Americans believe in our so much you always speculate as that and oftentimes that's amended after preliminary denials and
was there anything in your discovery that led you to put against the doctor that led you preliminary prior trial to believe that you had a negligent credential in the case?
Of course, we never did conduct any discovery whatsoever with regard to the doctor's credentialing for supervision, for training, how Alliance Immediate Care trains or staffs or anything like that because we didn't need to. So basically, the remaining issue was as that doctor sat there on that day, should she have seen the red flag?
I want to get you to the other issue of this case, or you want to get to that at least. But what I'm interested in is the big picture substantial justice here, or miscarriage of substantial justice. So if I understand it correctly, the one thing that you have to hang your hat on in terms of that is that you missed the opportunity for a potential negligent credentialing case against this corporation.
Yes, that's if I had this trial were to restart over again in all its aspects tomorrow, and in fact if everybody filed an answer and if everyone denied responsibility, then we explore all of those issues. And many of the issues that you saw was a convoluted economic and contractual web between all these related corporations and hospitals. So that record reflects some of the contracts required one group to come to the defense and provide testimony for another group.
But since no answers had ever been filed, there was nothing prohibiting you from filing another amended complaint, even without legal support, because no answers were filed.
That's true, Your Honor.
So you were completely free if you had any sniff of the negligent potential claim to go ahead and file.
I was free to kill the dragon twice, but there's no need to do that. And I'm guessing that's the truth.
When you say kill the dragon twice, do you mean the first killing was a default judgment, or the first killing was the basis upon which you made the allegations in your original complaint?
The original complaint, and maybe killing is too active a term. In effect, that dragon was out of the picture. That dragon had rolled over, hopefully with his hind legs up in the air, because he didn't play by the rules. He's no longer in the arena. I don't have to worry about this dragon coming back in under the rules.
You wouldn't worry about a 6B motion or about him coming in and saying, excusable neglect, we have a good reason why we didn't file our answer, and so here it is. You wouldn't worry about that at all. And this killing of the dragon twice, I'm really intrigued by that because usually the complaint seems to me that everything's there. I mean, you cover yourself so that you can always drop them out, but...
It's almost like the dangers between clashing rocks of Scylla and the Oracle of Charybdis, Your Honor. Do I wake up this person, this dragon that I think is dead? Do I say, are you really dead or are you going to come back and file something? Or do I just say, there's... four or five or six other defendants, there's 12 expert witnesses, there's all these issues swirling. But these rules are here for effective and efficient administration of justice. That issue is done. Let me go to all these other things that will already take a three-week trial, and they did.
Let me take that to the substantial justice of which, by the time the trial starts, the dragon is not dead. That's right.
We're not sure.
You've got two legs up, maybe.
Yeah. Well, but
it's quivering.
Yeah, I mean, you lost on that issue right before trial. So they're alive, as far as you know.
On the first day of trial, the motion for default was denied. There was no motion at that time for a 6B, as is appropriate. There was an oral incantation of, this is a 60B issue right here, and this is a 60B, excuse me, but I don't know, just chanting those words creates a motion as such. On the second day of trial, the answer comes in under a wrong name, under the name of the defendant that's no longer there. So the dragon, somebody's dragon is alive. It's still not the dragon of AIC. It's on the second day of trial, Your Honor. AIC still is not legally in existence in this case.
And is that really the heart of your belief that this, that the rules were not adhered to? Procedurally, do you concede that it, that at the time the trial court granted the or denied the motion for default judgment and left room for filing an answer, that procedurally was correct, that there was a the court can, unless you think it's an abuse of discretion, but the court may permit an answer to be filed late under 6B.
There is a procedure for a late filing.
Do you think that he didn't meet it?
Utilized, right. Your Honor, there was no 6B motion made and no.
So you say that even at that level, it didn't meet 6.
That's right. And then at the end of the case, when the judge is about to send the jury forms to the jury, I once again say you're sending a jury form for a legally non-existent defendant, Your Honor, AIC. Still to this date, there is no filing of an answer. Not at that time, not in any post-judgment proceedings, not today, as the dragon of AIC ever reared its head. Now, if that's the rule...
Well, it is a defendant. He said, no, it's not existent defendant. You sure want it to be a defendant.
Yeah, well, I guess he isn't quivering yet. I guess legally he's still up with a couple hind legs up in the air. So if that is the rule, then basically I guess the new rule that the appellants would have us adopt is that at any time, that if you're an employer, no matter how much goes through the courthouse, no matter how much time has gone by, if you're fortuitous enough to have your employee win, then whatever has happened 2-3 years down previous, that can exonerate you. And if that's the rule, if that's going to be the rule...
That has to be the rule for both sides.
Yes, sir.
Because as a matter of fact, if you make that the rule and we rule on 6B, then you make 6B covering all sins.
That's right. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's attractive to attorneys because we would like to have all our sins covered because God knows we make mistakes. But there's a reason for rules. There's a reason for jurisdictional rules. There's a reason for procedural rules. We have all lived and died by that sword, and that's part of our professionalism. Sometimes we make the mistakes. Oftentimes, as in this case, I believe a client made a mistake, maybe both. We don't know that, but it's not before the court. So if the rules are good because they give us a way to manage litigation and people's rights and people's claims, they're good for both sides.
You need to ought to have a chance to talk about the commonality of interest, and your time is up, so you better do it quickly.
Okay.
I'll ask you the question so you can do it.
Very quickly, I would suggest that the Silva's opinion in each did not limit the commonality of interest to a specific defendant and his chosen expert. In fact, the exact verbiage of the Silva's opinion said that in a medical malpractice action, evidence of a commonality of insurance interest between a defendant and an expert witness is sufficiently probative of the expert's bias, et cetera, et cetera. That opinion stated what we all know. Bias, prejudice, preconceived notions do not attach and limit themselves to individuals. They go to groups of individuals. In this case, the group of individuals similarly situated that all benefited from both general and specific testimony of the PIE expert were three urgent care / emergency physicians.
Well, doesn't even the jury's verdict here the show that, I mean, you had been multiple defendants here, and to say that an expert who testifies on behalf of one of the defendants thereby benefits all defendants is a pretty broad brush. And why don't we, if we're going to do that, why don't we just say that insurance, information about insurance or non-insurance is to be allowed, admitted in every case, every PI case. That'd be better, it seems to me, than a rule like such as you're proposing.
I think it applies to all defendants similarly situated. And the defendants issued in the our cross appeal and the appeal uncertainty of the defendants is that we had to be in this failure to diagnose rupture of dependency. Position number one, Dr. Lonary, red flags. Position number two, Dr. Seri, red flags. These are both emergency or urgent care physicians, both faced with the same signs and symptoms, which should have to a rational practitioner set up bells and alarms. That's the testimony.
Was Seri in the emergency room? I wasn't clear. Was Dr. Seri in the...
Yes, he's an emergency room physician. And his employer is EM Care Alliance. Dr. Seri, of course, is the person by stipulation that we dismissed from the case just to keep corporate commitment. But basically, the expert says this is a difficult diagnosis for any urgent care or emergency type of physician because all of these signs and symptoms were so difficult to perceive. It was difficult. He doesn't have to say it's difficult for Dr. Lonary, who saw the same signs and symptoms, or Dr. Seri a couple of days later, because now the opinion's out in the courtroom. It's been painted with a broad brush as to those physicians. That expert and at our reach should apply to the surgeon 2 weeks later down the road because a lot of other things have happened. But in terms of those initial phases with the initial physicians where it's not a hospitalization, the patient comes in, presents himself, it's just outpatient care and attention, those things are relevant because if this expert witness is able to persuade the jury that, gosh, this is a hard diagnosis and how can we expect these doctors to pick it up at this stage, then all of those defendants similarly situated benefit. And we've pointed out in our brief all of the excerpts where this testimony, both general and specific, in fact, inures to the benefit of these defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Plekis. Thank you. Mr. Simon, rebuttal for appellants. You've used your time, but take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll keep my comments brief because I think the issues have already been hashed out. I represent the cross-appellee in this matter. Immediate Medical Services, Inc., as the court is aware, is a freestanding immediate care center or urgent care center, which Mr. Davis presented to on April 9, 1991. Dr. Ganeri was the physician, an independent contractor who happened to be working at that facility on April 9. She was not employed by Immediate Medical Services. Immediate Medical Services has no commonality of insurance interest whatsoever with any of the other defendants or any of the other expert witnesses that testified in this case. Immediate Medical Services is insured by OHIC, the Ohio Hospital Insurance Corporation. None of the other defendants or none of the other expert witnesses were represented by OHIC. The Eid case, which was cited by the plaintiff in support of the proposition that the case should be reversed with respect to Immediate Medical Services, requires that there be a commonality of insurance interest so that some evidence of bias or some indication of bias be present.
Well, Dr. Seri was your employee, is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I didn't employ any of the physicians.
All right.
We were in the freestanding urgent care facility that the patient presented to. The only claim against us is under an ostensible agency theory because the doctor was practicing out of our facility. Not an employee, no relationship.
And boiling it all down, your issue is the same as EM Care.
I wouldn't agree with that, Your Honor, no, because at least with respect to EM Care, they have a commonality of insurance interests. That commonality being, they are insured by PIE, and an expert witness called by another defendant was also insured by PIE. So you do have, arguably, a commonality of insurance interests.
So you're arguing you're two steps removed, at least.
At least two steps removed. We're as far removed as you could possibly imagine. I try to think of a scenario in which you could be more further removed the immediate medical services last night, and I couldn't come up with anything. This is as far removed as you could possibly be.
You've used your time.
Okay, I would thank you. Thank the court for listening to my argument. We would ask you to affirm the Court of Appeals judgment and the jury verdict in favor of IMS.
Thank you. Mr. Herron, take a minute.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Herron. I also represent the cross-appellate Devlin Davis in this case, and I would like to respond briefly to the argument of IMS and presumably of Dr. Bonieri, too, who is in the same situation. I think the court touched upon this effect a little bit in its prior argument, where in a medical malpractice case, the credibility of the expert witness turns cases on a lot of issues. Okay, and what I think IMS's argument in this case is not giving effect to the true prejudicial nature of the inability of the cross-appellant's counsel to explore the potential bias of Dr. Janiak. Three emergency medical providers are in this case. Dr. Janiak is an emergency medical provider. He has a commonality of insurance interests with one of them. Therefore, he has a reason to be potentially biased. He therefore goes on to talk about standards of care of emergency medicine, how you diagnose an appendicitis condition, whether an ER physician can even make the diagnosis, and how you treat that condition. Direct contradiction to what plaintiff's expert has said. By our inability to challenge Dr. Janiak's potential
defendant's expert,
his opinion, his testimony is made more credible. And that testimony not only applies to the people with whom he has a commonality of interest with, it also applies to people, other defendants, similarly situated. Obviously, we're not trying to get a reversal on the judgment by of the surgeon. He's not similarly situated. Dr. Guarnieri, Pelli, Dr. Guarnieri, and IMS are similarly situated. They benefited from the unchallenged testimony, which the trial court's error allowed the court to allow the jury to hear. And based upon that, we believe that the court should further recognize and expand, as Judge William D. Hoffman of the Fifth District did, that said the jury should be determined what should know the bias, and then the jury should be allowed to determine how that bias affects their interpretation of the credibility of that expert witness, whether to believe all or part of it. And based upon that, we ask for a reversal of the Court of Appeals opinions affirming the judgments of IMS and Dr. Guarnieri.
Thank you, Mr. Herron.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.